John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Trax FM, Trax FM, Trax FM, Trax FM.
Welcome to John Bouts, all the rage. We're here, hopefully tech-free or not being attacked by gremlins, probably in the government. There's a lot of gremlins there. Welcome to John Bouts, all the rage. One of the subjects we're covering off, I think, is a certain national insurance rise, which seems to be bypass certain elements of society. They call them the elite, but I think that's a compliment. I won't do that anymore. John?
Yeah, as you were saying, hopefully we won't have too many technical problems, even connection to reality, but we'll see how it goes. I am just going to see if I can find something to plug my earphones in. Sorry to keep you all waiting, but give us 2 secs. And yeah, there we go. That's just a little bit better for me to
Oops, we seem to have lost John temporarily there. Hopefully he'll be back shortly. But yeah, we were talking about national insurance rises and what it means. What it means for those in society that are near the poverty line anyway. So hopefully we're going to get John back very, very, very shortly. I'm going to try and get one of these going. Let's have a look. We'll try one of these. How's that? So you listen to John Bouts, all the rage. Hopefully we're up and running very shortly.
We'll be right back.
When John Baird has a breakdown, not mental, technical, you can get
I've
to hear
of those.
You can get to hear a bit of jazz funk. That is Ayrton Moreira and Toque de Cuica. John Baird's all the rage. John is in a safe place. He's monking himself as safe to internet. And it's up and running and working. John?
Yes, I am. The sound of my breakdowns are jazz funk. It sounds like the title of a poem, actually. I might crib that. As I say, me and Dave were just discussing. I have no idea what you picked up from what I said before, but I'm going to... I'm just going to start from the top and say that this show is going to be a bit of an old school one where I just came up with basically a subject I wanted to talk about and just went, let's write down a few notes about this and then just go into it. And it grew into something else and it builds up a few other things such as the tax wise we're going to talk about. But to begin with, this week's main focus, this week we're going to talk about is maturity. So basically... Some of my opinions on it. I mean, this is not a comprehensive thing. It's going to be something that we probably come back to a few times. But I mean it in kind of relation to politics, in relation to people's attitudes and behaviours, and just basically straight up my opinions about something. Obviously, what I'm going to talk to you now is to some degree factual, and to some degree it's just my opinion, which me and Dave will hopefully talk about back and forth. So I'll start here. Over the last 40-odd years, citizens have progressively lost political power. This was the plan, as collective power and therefore power over our own lives was systematically taken apart and moved beyond our reach. Now work is precarious, food is scarce, and for many people, and the only power that any of us ever seem to have, in theory at least, is consumerism. Many economic actors adapted to this, launching us into a world of credit so more people could theoretically at least afford to obtain the various playthings that keep so many people occupied on an everyday basis. Debt is a subject for at least one or two shows in themselves, but we can say for its position in what we're talking about tonight, it definitely plays a role, as it always has, in effectively keeping people controlled. So political power dialed down and lifestyle consumption ramped up. Until now, we have gone so much further in the world that we're living in at this point. One aspect of this hyper-consumption, and immaturity is admittedly not the only reason for this, but I do think it's important, it has become the main way of expression for millions through consumption. One part of the failure of collective action and our power to overcome this is a withdrawal into the self and the idea that meeting consumer demand is the only real power that you can ever have. So we've seen a rise not just in overconsuming, but also the demand to have it all quicker and with bells on, basically. This shows an immaturity to me, a pathetic, childish demand to have what I want now and more of it in a minute. How exactly can someone propose limits on their children's behaviour when they do not exercise such things themselves, for instance? Up and down the land now, all we have are people clicking this and that, buying crap, buying toys and playthings at a rate of knots. Yet you proclaim to teach children that they cannot have whatever they want whenever they want it. Well, you clearly can, so what's the difference? It's basically ice cream for dinner every night. Now, is this a capitalist thing? Is it an idea of as you get older or grow up or whatever and all that shite, you can consume whatever you want, whatever you can get your hands on, therefore it's justified? Has it all become a question of income? There is little to no thought beyond the process of quick satisfaction. No responsibility is taken for the reduction process, despite decades of campaigning to raise awareness about these things. No one cares if their stuff is made by someone overworked or even suffering slave labour, it seems. Many people do not seem to care if their stuff is made by children. You were even ordering masses of clothing during the lockdown, which was a massive confusion to me because where the fuck are you going? But there you go. Some have argued in favour of this process as some kind of great freedom, but that simply does not hold up. Today, we experience a lack of power in our own lives in all ways, and buying a bunch of crap is a pitiful way to try and shift that feeling of emptiness. It will not offset the problems we face in the world, because switching off never ever does. Okay, so that's the consumption aspect. Moving on to another sign of part of our immaturity. Attacking the left. Now, another aspect that intersects with modern immaturity is denial of political alternatives, no matter how badly the present state is going. A major aspect of this is cheap and cynical attacks against the left. The present leadership of the Labour Party is solely obsessed with destroying the left within their own party. They have no policy or plans for going forward, in fact, nothing serious about Keir and his handlers at all. Media in this country is so twisted in this hate, they warn of a great terror if we were to put a socialist in charge, then praise a Conservative government for adapting the same policies in a time of crisis. The policies that a Corbyn-led Labour Party put forward were not only popular, they are vital for saving us from complete destruction. And right now it seems only the Conservatives of all people are admitting to it, without actually admitting to it, of course. When we talk about changing the nature of society, for instance, praising key workers above parasites like landlords and capital speculators or corporations, pointing out gig workers provide more service and keep the country running while stockbrokers and e-commerce twits who produce nothing are seen as the height of aspiration. In fact, we are encouraged to give in to them and give in to their endless demands and leave them with totally unaccountable power. The result has completely disempowered us, the regulars, everyday people, whatever you want to call it, citizenry even. If you propose taxes on the rich, or, God forbid, stopping them doing the destructive things they do by passing laws, a common response from people with a straight face is things like, oh, I suppose you'll be rounding us all up next, will you? We are literally talking about a political decision to adjust the economy. Perfectly legitimate action, a perfectly legitimate argument that should be argued with educated objection at best. Instead, we get something from the underfed minds of war obsessives making ridiculous claims. All the while, I'm told not to dismiss such overgrown children. Because for some reason it's unacceptable to do so. Apparently we're supposed to debate and understand their silly perspective. Also, where exactly are the anti-Semitism crowd when all this is being said? You make clear people making cheap comparisons to the real and devastating suffering of the Holocaust, including the likes of Margaret Hodge, claiming that being questioned for her disgusting conduct was like the Gestapo coming for her. This person is not met with anywhere near the condemnation I might have given them versus creating a politically useful conspiracy based on two tweets that people Jeremy Corbyn once met might have sent. At the highest level of this terrible power structure, we are now all subject to the totally uncontrolled and rampant desires of these ultra-grown children at the front of companies like Amazon, Tesla, Virgin, Google and many others. In other words, companies that have produced absolutely nothing. The ego of the Bezos or Musk types of the world goes into hyperspin when they are not praised for their supposed genius, despite not actually having any. Now, we see them all as this pathetic one-upmanship push of trying to get into space the quickest and the fastest. Right, so I just got to intervene here a sec. Sorry, Dave, can you still hear me okay? Okay, so I had to move for a second, and sorry to break the flow, but I just want to make sure that I'm still coming through. Okay, sounding good, sounding mad, but sounding good. Okay, so that was just talking about the way that the left is treated. Obviously, we'll come back to that in a minute with myself and Dave, but I just want to just carry on a couple more bits on this front, and then we can feedback on the whole thing. Okay, so. Something else that I made a note of recently about responses to the loss of the Afghan war. And let's call it what it is, because that's what it was. We could do a much deeper dive on Afghanistan at some point and losing that war. Or we could just leave it to the pros. And there's a lot of very good podcasts out there, many of whom I've probably either consciously or unconsciously cribbed a lot of my pieces from. But let's just say there's one aspect that we're seeing a lot of right now is a kind of war brain that certain people have. And it's particularly very relevant to ex-empires like the one that we live in, feeling as if something has been lost to them personally, which I find
not only repulsive and offensive in a lot of ways, but also especially among those who probably haven't even thought about Afghanistan for about 10 years at least. It's the usual kind of thing, basically suburban dads who wear tactical cargo shorts and stuff like that and Under Armour T-shirts are now claiming that they could win this entire war by themselves with no experience of anything harsher than a shoving match at a barbecue to their name. These armchair hard men were the ones demanding a demented allegiance a decade or so ago to all British armed forces, no matter the human rights violations that they committed. And then they forgot about Afghanistan for, as I said, at least a decade, probably more, and now claim that they could actually do a better job because their action man fantasies are being subsumed by the imperial humiliation of losing yet another war. Not very supportive of our boys, as you like to call them, after all. Speaking of that support, by the way, how many of the unquestioning thug worshippers actually volunteer any of their time to help the sadly broken bodies returning from this or any other conflict? Instead, they remain on the sidelines calling for an endless war because it makes them feel a little bit better. Try drinking more water. I don't know. Something else might make you feel better that doesn't involve destruction and fucking up other people's lives. To be fair, though, I do actually think in this case, this gaggle are actually in the minority. I think the vast majority of people appear to agree with ending that terrible and pointless conflict in Afghanistan. And even the usual anti-refugee rhetoric is a bit less pronounced, at least, when relating to Afghans, at the moment anyway. Of course, the country is still accepting drastically too few of them. But again, I mean, that's something else we'll try and get somebody on. I'm hoping to get somebody on from a couple of the refugee charities, actually, wherever I can. I do not think most people have even thought about Afghanistan, as I said, for quite some time. The vast majority of its cheerleaders are really just in politics and the media, and are totally disconnected from real life. I'd also say comparatively, it's actually worse in America on this one than it is over here. But that's just that. Okay. Next up. Oh, mate. Go ahead. You grab that phone. I don't think anyone can hear it except you and me. Okay. We're often told that the things that we want politically, a fairer society, equality of access to healthcare worldwide, and an end to political extremism, or even just to actually get paid when you go to work, we're often told that these things are somehow impossible. Of course, it is partly true that these things are not possible right now, in a manner of speaking, because the present system dominating politics of uncontrolled capital exploitation via neoliberal ideology does not allow anything different. It's actually designed and planned to make sure that nothing else can be done. It is a political choice, however, to follow the same political and social trajectory of the last 40 years or so, no matter how much it fails. And that is a political choice that is being made by pretty much all political actors that we're faced with right now. One of the things that is presently paralysing the Labour Party here in Britain and many other supposedly left alternatives around the world is an unwillingness to break with the failed politics of the past. Even after total disasters like the crash of the late 2000s and the terrible toll of the COVID-19 pandemic, the system has completely failed. Yet, we have no political leadership to take us forward because they refuse to grow up and admit to failure. Also, because of the close relationship between the political elites and the media, many simply do not have the guts or maturity to fight against this. This is somewhat understandable when you see how Bernie Sanders was treated in America and even more so in the disgraceful treatment of Jeremy Corbyn here in Britain, which continues, in fact, to this day, even though he's no longer Labour leader. For the quite mildly socially democratic policies that the Labour Party proposed under his leadership, he has been demonised in the media as someone who would destroy the country, which Boris Johnson seems to be doing a damn good job of already. He would somehow destroy the economy and cause mass shortages of food. Yes, yet again, I refer you to the ardent capitalist Boris Johnson and his Tory party, done pretty well without any help from the likes of Jeremy. Meanwhile, while that stuff has been happening, commentators have cast their eyes across empty shelves in supermarkets and compared it to the end of days Soviet Union, or speculated in some truly ridiculous and unprovable way of how this would somehow be worse under a Corbyn leadership. Again, what else to say about this and just how bloody childish? You know, it's the reality that's facing you right now, right in front of your eyes, right under your nose, and you're going, oh, well, I'm sure it would be worse if he was here, and isn't it just like the end of the Soviet? No, it's like the end of capitalism. That's what it's like. Okay, so it's right there. You're living through it. These are, of course, the same grown-ups who labelled Corbyn and the rest of us as anti-Semitic for standing up for Palestinians. These were the ones who were equating the political ideology of Zionism with the very identity and existence of anybody Jewish, which in itself is insulting and, I believe, a rather anti-Semitic view. All of this did not prevent a hung parliament and Labour gaining 40% of the vote in 2017. Never let the memory hold this, OK? That happened. Or for that matter, when they even gained 32% in the far worse election results of 2019. All things that the adults in the room want you to forget while they try to resurrect politics of the late 1990s, which so far, with the leadership they've got at the moment, is lucky to get them minus approval points. So I'm not quite sure why they think this is going to work. Anyway, so rounding off just this small section of the show, this lack of maturity does not explain everything, but it is an aspect of our times. Out of control egos combined with endless access to riches and power for the worst people, and it has led us to the status of a near failed state and as part of a wider failed system globally. Meanwhile, our everyday activities are endangering the world and making life worse for people so removed from our perspective we simply do not recognise their humanity. Sadly, nothing's changed there. None of the horrors that we might have associated with yesterday are ever really gone. There are racism, sexism, homophobia and ableism, to name a few, still haunt everyday life, rearing their very ugly heads at the very least provocation. An immature society will never overcome these terrible problems. While the worst things affecting all of us right now, the threat of climate breakdown, is simply not being met because far too many people cannot grow up and face the fact that everything needs to change in order to prevent this from happening, including specifically changing the way that we live. It will take all of us to overcome this state, and as I say, we'll go into it in greater detail in future shows. But we need to end up being more than just consumer subjects. Otherwise, this terrible state of affairs is never going to be broken. So we really better start growing up. Okay, Dave, give me your feedback. Ah, are you there? Hold on a second. I hope you haven't texted me anything because I left my phone downstairs. Okay, if Dave's not back with us yet, then I will just carry on for a minute with the tax rises. Okay, give us a sec, folks. I'm just gonna get the rest of my stuff up and carry on here. Right. Okay, let's go into talking about the tax rise. So recently, the Tories announced their plans to raise the rate of national insurance contributions specifically to pay for the care crisis in Britain, which was bad before COVID-19 and has been hit very badly since. Now, this rise has many problems and it's likely not to actually work for the intention it was made for. But as soon as the media began to report this, they started with the division tactics of who's going to pay this, who it will affect, and basically trying to start a fight. Now, we fail on this already when we allow ourselves to get pulled into a binary argument about the increases in tax and who should be paying it and all of that kind of stuff. It's mostly going to be, we're told, the kind of richer people will pay it, but I don't think that actually stands up. What it appears to be is that the younger people in the working sector are more likely to be paying this and be paying a substantially higher rate in real terms than those with property and other such such riches. Now, the government have claimed this is a progressive tax. Statistics on the government website show increases will affect the highest earners the most. For instance, those earning £100,000 upwards will be paying over £1,000 more a year. But actually, this doesn't really make it a progressive tax. The wealthy can spare £1,000 more than the lowest earners can spare, for instance, £130 that the same kind of government statistics said that those on the lowest incomes would be paying. So the rich should actually pay a higher rate, not a higher total. And this tax is, in that sense, totally progressive. Income tax, for instance, is more progressive for a similar reason. With national insurance, the more you earn, the lower the rate that you actually pay, up to a certain point. it's basically like a cut-off point. I mean, they don't really discuss this in the same ways, but I gathered a lot of information from other places of media intrigue, like, you know, Navarra Media and places like that. Well, the Tory government have claimed taxes are higher than they have been since whenever. This is not actually true across the board. Corporation tax is a mere 19% and income tax is at 45%. VAT is at 20% and everybody pays exactly the same on that one. So very, very not progressive. What this is actually about, as ever, is paying for tax cuts for the rich, protecting assets for the rich at the expense of the working class, as has always been under neoliberalism, as we all pay for a crisis that we did not cause, be it a crash or a post-pandemic economic slump. What we should be talking about here is a wealth tax. The people who made the most amount of money during the pandemic are doing what they always have done, which is basically sitting on their arse while things that they own, such as housing, increases in value. That's where we should be targeting this tax. The tax increase looks by some measure like a raid on working people's pay packets to plug holes in parts of the NHS. Many people in the care sector do not seem to have much good to say about it. And as for underfunding the NHS, well, that has been a political plan for at least the last decade, along with plenty of other cuts and just general attacks on working people and lives and pay packets. The question right now is who is going to make the argument for a wealth tax? Well, certainly it seems not the Labour Party right now, whose leader doesn't share this view anyway, and even if he did, Peter Mandelson would probably kick it out of him. This lack of opposition is one reason why nothing will change unless we force it to. Some are crowing about Boris Johnson breaking a manifesto pledge, but this does not really matter in the modern political climate, at least not if you're a right-wing and establishment figure like him and his truly awful party. If he breaks any kind of manifesto pledge for something that people think is important, like social care, plus there is no alternative offered by the opposition, nobody really cares about breaking a pledge. Simple as that. In other words, Johnson will get further with the public by adopting an admittedly watered down, but nevertheless, a popular economic idea, more like those pledged in the Labour manifestos that were brought out under Jeremy Corbyn. Meanwhile, Starmer says that the Tories can no longer be the party of low tax. Well, I don't think that really has much impact. You know, that's such a weak-willed and sort of establishment line that no one other than those on the inside are ever really going to care about. And, well, and those who are wealthy enough to not pay anywhere near enough tax in the first place. By the way, the wealth tax is actually very popular with the public in the same way that corporation tax is. But again, the issue of who is really paying for this is not talked about. While we argue over old versus young, for instance, we forget the poorest people who will and always do pay the most and suffer the loss. Around 50% of those receiving social care are those with disabilities and specific needs, not just people who happen to be in the old age bracket, whatever that is these days. Like benefits, many are used by those in work because they have to. And as ever, this is really about the poor paying for the rich. And until there is a radical shift, such as a wealth tax, this is not going to change. Now, excuse me. Just quickly. Sorry, Dave, are you back with us? Oh, yeah, that's okay, mate. You may have texted me to tell me you were going off for a sec, but I left my phone downstairs.
No, it's all right. Carry on, John.
Okay. So I was just going to say... I'll tell you what... Why don't you feed back quickly on some of it? So I did my thing about maturity, and I did the thing about I started doing a thing about the tax. Do you have anything you want to point back in on that?
No, I when we talk about attack on the left, so I'm going to put my middle head on now. Not that I necessarily agree with it, but I'm just saying, just to add a slant to the debate. So there is a thought that the left wish to have everything, I don't know what people, there's a perception of that, I would imagine, looking at the front pages of the right-wing media, there's a perception of what the left wants. There's a perception that we're going to leave large debt. There's a perception that we all want to be vegans. There's a perception that we wouldn't give up our mobile phones and give up our Sony PlayStations, though. How does that sound, you know? And that's not what, I don't think that's what the left's actually saying. And it's interesting, really interesting, that Michael Moore rescreened 9/11 or 11/9 Fahrenheit, the 2004 brilliant movie on the Iraq War and Afghanistan War. He did a special screening on YouTube. Record amounts of people watched it from all around the world. He had special guests, Q&A at the end. And a lot of the emails and letters were from 18-year-olds who weren't even born in 9/11. And basically, it was the right time to talk about it. Was it really worth it? Who benefited from it? Who gave the order? And why? And record, you know, the BBC would have loved those viewing figures he got on YouTube. ITV would have loved those viewing figures. He absolutely caned it. And it was refreshing to see the Q&A from kids who weren't even born, as I said. They were talking about 2003, 2004, and talking about it and questioning their government's decisions on lots of things. And there was people from Europe watching, Philippines, Indonesia, the UK, and they were asking questions on their government's decisions, or governments, or the establishment's decisions. So when we talk about tax rises, and some people say, well, it's got to be done, someone's got to pay for it, I get that. If I had my you-know-what head on, I get that. I know the argument. But why is it we swallow it when certain people say it, or certain governments say it? When someone else says it, oh, he's mad, he is. He's, oh, look, who's going to pay for that? How are we going to pay for that? Woo! But now it's okay. And what bothers me about this, and it's sad, and it's a sad indictment of society in general, is that someone gets up and says, you're going to have to pay more. Some of you. Not all of you. Some of you. And what bothers me, you swallowed it. That's what bothers me. And that's the thing that gets me. And I think we're just apathetic as society. Secondly, about the universal credit cut, there was a view, they were planning to do this anyway, right? But they were hopefully going to take it off the society, or part of society, which would had a problem with voting because of the ID, right? Unfortunately, the people claiming universal credit is their base. Now, so I think that one ski-woof, that strategy. But then, I haven't seen much strategy from the current administration. I don't care who they are, I'm just saying I haven't seen much strategy. John?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of it. There's lots of feedback on that. Firstly, what's interesting is the film you mentioned, Fahrenheit 9/11, which, of course, was shown to kind of mark the end, as it were, of active conflict in Afghanistan. And one of the things about that time, which many of us might remember, and I openly state, by the way, as much as I hate Donald Trump and those around him, he was nowhere near as bad as George W. Bush. He hasn't got as many bodies to his name, for starters. Bush, one of the things Bush came out and said was, we have to carry on and shop. You know, you have to fight terrorism by going out and shopping. Basically, maintaining this system, keep it up, keep consuming. That's the thing that is somehow some kind of great patriotic duty. You know, buy horrendously petrol guzzling cars and carry on shopping. Well, that system is part of what I'm talking about. It's part of what led to that. And that lack of asking questions, or that being a wider part of apathy, is, again, not solely and completely caused by immaturity, but there is, I think, a very, very strong aspect of that. There's a lack of desire to take care. There's a lack of desire, not just for yourself, but for others, and a lack of desire to actually engage with the real world. Now, part of that problem, and it's funny, this coming up with a social care bill, is a bit like we've seen with a lot of COVID-19 stuff, particularly kind of resistance to it, is really at heart, and again, my catchphrase again, we will go about into this in more detail in another show, but at heart, what that's really about is people resisting the very idea of caring about others. It is a mindset that is so totally alien to them. You might have to stop doing something that you want to do, such as get on a, you know, walk down the street and get on a train and go to a large packed building without a mask on, or this kind of thing. you know, you might actually have to do that for the sake of other people. And for some people, that, especially certain, you know, conservative politicians or just the conservative mindset in general, drives them absolutely nuts. How dare you require me to do something for the sake of others? It really is just so alien to their mindset. I don't think that's talked about enough. As for, you know, feeding back on your point about the attacks on the left, I mean, firstly, the economy is so, you know, oh, someone has to pay for this, someone has to pay for that. Well, the reason we're looking at this now, the reason people are trying to make a big deal out of tax rises is because of their specific need for social care. You know, we are all paying in order to benefit. We are all paying to not even just benefit. I don't think that's the right word because that's such a loaded word in our culture. But in order to allow people to carry on to the best of their ability to live sort of decent, dignified lives when that becomes much harder for them, as old age, for instance, naturally does. But also, as I say, coming back to the amount of people who are drawing some of these benefits and this kind of credit because they have to, whether it's because they are so badly paid that they need credit and food banks, etc., on top of their actual working wages, which aren't being paid enough because, again, we're not actually tackling the kind of people that employ them in these jobs who are, you know, getting away with not paying the taxes properly and stuff like that. Not only is it that, but again, some people, as I mentioned, with disabilities and different abilities who are also having to draw certain amounts of credit while working, etc. I just say credit, sorry, benefits, what I should say. You know, these people are a major part of our society, and they're as good as the rest of us, and they should be respected in the same way. Now, trying to kind of start a fight between people like that. I mean, let's not forget disability benefit cuts, among others, over the last 10 years have been incredibly damaging. You know, people have died. I mean, one of the things that we weren't talking about anywhere near enough before COVID-19 came along to kill masses of people was benefit cuts in Britain killing masses of people. You know, it's as simple as that. We were just not talking about it. Our billionaire-owned media was not talking about it. Their representatives in government were getting away with murder, and they were allowing this to happen. And it all kind of comes down to the same thing to me. You know, when are you going to actually, what's going to push everyone to actually decide this is enough and we're going to address it? Maybe it's, you know, it's one little thing that kicks it off. You see this so often, don't you, in uprisings around the world. You know, Colombia, for instance, when our good friend Francisco talks about that, he talks about how the young people were the ones who had just had all of this injustice, and then finally one day they were being demanded to pay even more for their public transport, and that was it. They said enough, and that's what kicked it off. So I don't know. Do you think there's going to be a specific point, Dave, where it just kind of like people finally get it, or am I just...
2030, I keep saying 2030. I'm sorry if I keep going on about that. I think it's a generational thing. I think politics will either be relevant or it won't. I think we'll have a problem with governance. I think we'll have a constitutional crisis. I think we'll have a smaller majority. I think someone needs to be a bit more radical, otherwise it's going to lose it. We're just going to lose it. And it's going to be something we've never, ever seen before. But then I say that, we're seeing society and changes to our world of work, good and bad, are moving at such a fast pace, and I think we discussed it in the reps meeting, John, it got kind of coated over, but yeah. I think we're seeing a rise in mental health issues now than more than ever, because their world of work has changed, especially government agencies or ex-government agencies that the government's used to own. They typically work in the same way, in the same, it's very underfunded, and they've had to move and change overnight. And it's affecting people mentally. It's affecting people certainly in the benefits industry, the Department of Work and Pensions, PCS members who I speak to every day, and it's affecting them big style. John?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think there's definitely going to be elements of that. I think we're already having problems with mental health, problems and trauma and stuff like that growing. To be honest, if I can say anything to people suffering from that, I don't think you're sick. I think capitalism is. I think you're just responding to the world that you live in, and how can you not? But again, mentioning, as you did earlier on, mentioning younger people, you know, tuning into Michael Moore's film screening and asking lots of questions and stuff. That does certainly give me a degree of hope, because what you've got there is people who are not just going to put up with whatever the establishment, the established order slings at them. And I think that the established order in this country, being a very good example, is really, really suffering with that, because they have no other setting. They don't know what else to do. You know, they're always, as I think I mentioned earlier, with talking about some of the rampant egos that we have to face from the Bezos and the Musk and the Branson types of the world. You know, the thing they hate the most is that they don't own everything about us, including our feelings and opinions. What they hate is the fact that we don't admire them. You know, Simon Cowell's biggest problem is certainly nothing to do with money, because he's stolen shit tons of it from the artists, or I say artists with quotes, that he's put out into the world over the years. He's just pissed off because nobody likes him. Now, what you have there is something that we deeply need, because I don't just say this, you know, when you say someone's egotistical, it's kind of like an insult in itself. I don't mean it like that. I mean, this is something that I think is deeply, deeply dangerous. Now, these people are adding to burning up the atmosphere because they're trying to get a bloody spaceship up into the sky, or whatever else they're doing with the likes of Amazon or Tesla to get their stuff moved around the place, which is no good for the environment. And then it's not like they're doing it for our benefit, because people say, oh, you know, Amazon employs so many people. Yeah, they do. And they treat them like absolute shit, and they union bust them. And people who are working for Amazon are some of those people who are also on going to food banks and on universal credit as well, because they have to be. So don't tell me Amazon's doing them a favor. That's absolute shite. But what I would say is with the, you know, the interest of younger people, well, you know, they're more receptacle to this kind of politics, this kind of need for change that we're talking about. Now, as I've always said to anyone about my politics, you can call it radical if you want to, but it's your society that makes me radical. I don't think my ideas and policies are particularly out there. I mean, what kind of things do we talk about, Dave? What do we talk about at the show? What do we talk about in our meetings? You know, people getting paid for the work that they do. Well, how the fuck did that become radical? You know, people having healthcare, people having, you know, being able to organise and control their own lives, people not suffering from terrible mental health, people not ending up in the street. And the idea, again, it's such an immaturity to say, firstly, you know, government debt is far more nuanced than that. You know, the government has as many debts as they want to. If they want to kind of, you know, print money and pay off their own debts, they can. They don't owe it to a bank, they owe it to themselves. As I say, we should get a full economist on to explain this better than I do. But, you know, that's one aspect of it. It's such a lie. But this idea that everything is about some kind of binary choice. Well, you know, if you stop homelessness, then you won't be able to buy a new PlayStation. You won't be able to produce a new PlayStation. Bitch, what are you talking about? Like, this is what I'm talking about, the kind of immaturity. Where do you buy this shit from? It's just utter garbage. Oh, society suddenly somehow cannot, you know, if all of us are provided with decent healthcare and treated equally, there won't be a PlayStation 6. My contempt for that idea is just overwhelming. Sorry, go on, mate.
I will search for an economist that gives both sides of the story, and I'm sure they will simplify what people see every day, things like inflation. What does that mean? Or, you know, yeah. I think all those narratives doesn't explain why you a rising pint of milk can take your family near the poverty line. When I was at school, this is what we learned in the 60s and 70s. If you're from a good paid job, you take your family out and you go into another establishment that pays its workers well. We spend money. Those workers then go out and spend money, and it's a dominoes effect. And we all pay our taxes and contribute to the social security and social welfare of where we live. And, you know, and that's how it works. Where it goes wrong and what the argument is, which is pay your tax, which is a big slogan on the internet at the moment. In fact, it's been trending for weeks now over everything else in the world. Tax the rich. That's a big trend at the moment, which is great. When the system fails, when those people stop paying tax or paying low tax and don't contribute, that's when you starve the things that our communities need. But if you're one of those people that you said, well, my community don't need free healthcare, or my parents don't need social care when they get old,
yeah,
that's fine. That's fine. I doubt it. I doubt you'll say that, because when it happens to you, it's not nice. It's not nice. I'm seeing in the workforce now a good 15% of our members having to go part-time to look after their parents. It does happen to you at some point. Don't say that, because you're a liar. John?
Yeah, I mean, well, you can relate to this one as much as I can. Excuse me. You know that non-union member, you know, the one that talks shit about the union, you know, until they get in trouble, then you come running, don't you? Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. That's where what you're describing there, actually, I think is a really good example. It's the sharp end of the social care crisis. You know, when all is said and done, when we finished arguing over which is the most progressive tax and who pay, well, we don't argue over that, actually. We're just told and told to lump it. And, you know, who pays it the most or whatever. You know, that's exactly the kind of example you've used right there. It's exactly the real life experience of it. Don't do anything for the rich people. All right? You don't owe them anything. OK, they are, you know, lying and indecent parasites. And we need to get out of the mindset of thinking that we are beholden to all of them. Before we go, I just want to add something about something else you might have heard about with this National Insurance Rise is them creating £36 billion for the NHS and for reforming social care's actual words. So I just want to make a couple more points about that. As I think I said earlier, the NHS has been underfunded for some time. The present governing party, in one format or another, has actively and purposely underfunded it for 10 years now. And it's not going to be nearly enough, again, to actually fill that gap. So, for instance, a couple of stats for you. In 2019, the NHS lost 20,000 beds, around 90,000 staff, and shut down over 100 A&E units. The NHS budget is more like £140 billion a year, and this has been squeezed for 10 years. So this £36 billion will not make nearly enough difference. The government also paid £37 billion to their friends at Serco and Citel for a test and trace operation that failed. So money for nothing, basically. And government have actually done nothing about it. They haven't tried to recapture it. They haven't presented Serco and Citel with a bill or anything like that. Perish the thought. This was, you know, juicy public contracts for their friends. Utter corruption is what we should call it. NHS trusts have said they need £10 billion in the next 6 months to tackle COVID costs and waiting lists. Government have offered them £5.3 billion, and the new money will not become available until April of next year, 2022. So waiting lists will continue being a problem. So if you think about that, that's going into the autumn. You know, we've just heard about some kind of autumn plan. Actually, I've got to say, there's a bit of the Keir Starmer effect to Boris Johnson the other day, because I listened to his plan, and by the end of it, I just kind of thought, I'm not sure I've actually heard anything. Was there a plan there? But anyway, there is no provision for preventing money leaking out of the NHS system and into the pockets of shareholders. The Health and Care Bill will really mean more privatisation, more social care, both homes and home visits and keeping people in homes and stuff like that is already privatised and outsourced anyway. You know, the amount of times now you see different ambulances out there that have come. There's one up the road from me, actually. And on the side of the van, it's got the NHS logo, and under that, it's got the G4S logo, which I find quite chilling. But yeah, that's basically private ambulances. You know, that's something that's been happening for some time. This privatisation is in effect, unfortunately, and that's where we're at with that. So again, yeah, the conversation should have been about social care, but instead we focused on tax. But you know, just I suppose summing up part of that, and maybe coming back on some what Dave and me have said tonight, that this kind of process of how these things are put out into the world, how they're supposedly discussed or debated within the media, is very anti-us. I should think of a better way of saying it than that. But it's this idea of no, you can't have anything better. No, you can't have any security. And then they'll wave, they'll wave a bloody PlayStation at you and say, oh, if that fella comes off the street, you can't have one of these. Just miserable. Just so, so pathetic. It really, really is. But yeah, so, sorry, Dave, do you want to come back on that? Or?
No, it's absolutely right. no, you carry on, John. I think we've covered that off quite well, although I still think the echo is out there. Well, someone's got to pay for it. That will be the echo. Anyway, John.
Well, I mean, when it comes down to it, all right, you want an answer to that question from me? Someone's got to pay for it. Yes, the rich. Okay, the people with the broadest shoulders, property owners, landlords, you know, parasites. That's those kind of. They can pay for it. You know, they're absolutely. Who's going to pay for it? You know, you have to have a proper system in place for extracting things like tax, like a wealth tax from people, because you can't rely on the, you know, benefits of, I'm trying to think of the right words, but for the, you know, for the right, for basically certain very well-off people to decide one day they're going to be nice to the world, you know, because they, well, okay, I'll tell you one of the things that system gets you. Firstly, you know, getting laptops to kids in Africa is all very well and good. I agree. But that Bill Gates is only going to do that for as long as he can be bothered to. And it doesn't actually leave the place in a stronger position, because that doesn't give citizens control over their own lives. That doesn't give people control over their own lives. They're sitting there effectively waiting for a handout. By the way, the bloke's got more money than God, so take all of his fucking laptops, okay, and take everything else. That's absolutely fine. If it's there, why would you say no to something that's free? But you can't imagine that's going to be a proper system. And it doesn't justify, for instance, the likes of him advocating for not ever paying part of a proper progressive tax system, which is a thing, you know, he does on top of that. Secondly, I think the best example I can think of for that system, for the present system we've got now, where, again, we're supposed to praise, you know, the hideously rich. I mean, by the way, they've never got their pay in any good way. Okay? There's no such thing as a moral or decent billionaire, because it just isn't possible. This system doesn't allow that to be possible. You're exploiting somebody somewhere along the line, and plenty of people. And as I say, just look at the system we have right now. You know, people, if I walk up the road tonight, if I go for a run when this is over, what I'll find when I get round to a certain corner is a whole bunch of fellas, well, a few corners in my area, hanging out on their bikes waiting for orders to come through. Those people are working. They're working while I'm out running. What they're not actually being, however, is paid, unless that phone bleeps, unless it clicks. And what they're being paid is minimal at best, and often in relation to other things they have to worry about, such as keeping their bike maintained, you know, keeping their uniform maintained, all this stuff that your any decent company should actually be doing for you. And that's the minimum we should have. Okay. But what this system gets you, in the words of a there's a Australian podcast that I listen to sometimes called On the Job, with Francis Leach, who I was going to talk about something he said tonight. Actually, I don't think we've got time for that. But anyway, and Sally Rugg. And Sally Rugg put it very, very well when she said, you know, I think about Jeff Bezos in this way. This is a man who gets up every morning and could actually solve world hunger, but decides not to. Instead, he'd rather build a spaceship. Well, that's what that kind of system gets you. Exactly that. You could do these things, but you don't. So yeah, we need smart and progressive taxes. Have I got time to talk about this last issue? Debatable. I don't know, Dave, do you want to feed back on that?
No, you go. Okay. If you can squeeze it in, Mrs.
Oh, I'll see if I can do it. All I was going to, I'll see if I can get it in before the fucking internet goes down again. All right. This was something I made notes on. Speaking a few weeks, so as I said, Francis Leach, a guy who does this podcast in Australia, I just found this story that he'd written about on a website. I thought, oh, this is worth, I'll just make some notes on this because it's kind of interesting. It's about wage theft. So wage theft has been outlawed in Queensland and Victoria in Australia. The legislation specifically uses offering these states workers proper protection against businesses stealing their pay, plus a form of redress when it does take place. Now, this should be much more enforceable than what was proposed and later abandoned by the Morrison government earlier this year. Specifically in Victoria, companies could be fined up to $1 million for deliberately underpaying staff. And by the way, just chipping in here for a sec, you notice one of the things that's happening at the moment with the industry, I want to call it the restaurant industry. That's not entirely right, is it? The catering industry. Yeah, I think that's what this is the right term for it in this country. Yeah, that kind of staffing. And of course, they're talking about Brexit and how that's had an effect on staff shortages. Yeah, sure it has. But also, it's worth remembering that that industry is notorious for being horrendously awful to their staff, overworking them, stealing tips, taking money out of their pay for this, that and the other. Byron, the burger, posh burger chain, employing nothing but people they knew to be illegally here. And then when they tried to unionise, they called in the border police. Shameful. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, let's not forget, it's not all down to one thing. It's a terrible industry. Anyway, back to Victoria and Queensland. Individual wage thieves could see fines of up to $200,000 and a maximum jail term of up to 10 years for deliberately underpaying staff. That's what I'm talking about. legislators now have this power to demand and request documentation from companies to compel attendance at meetings and have search and seizure powers. But as the aforementioned Francis Leach of On The Job website and podcast has put it, why is new legislation required to outlaw dodgy bosses stealing from their employees? To quote his article, how have we come to a point where the theft of workers' pay is so rampant and widespread that it's become part of the business model for so many employers that this now needs to be reined in by new laws to try and halt the practice? Yes, this is very much a Broken Arrow scenario. People who have seen that film will get that reference, and those of you who haven't, you're not as cool as me and my dad. Anyway, he points out that wage theft has always been illegal, but Australia, like this part of the world, has been subject over the last 25 years to attacks on unions in the workplace, and the result is a workforce that are far more vulnerable to bosses taking advantage of them. Anyway, shout out to Hospo Voice, the union that has worked on the front line in hospitality. That's the word I was thinking of earlier, hospitality, and instrumental in bringing in this legislation. Another good example overall of a need to be in a union if you want protection. All of this could meet stiff opposition from the government and their anti-worker stance going forward too. So even more reason to be ready to organise. As Francis Leach points out, restoring union power in the workplace is the only way to make sure that wage theft stops. Yeah, I totally agree. Dave, what do you think on that one? Okay. I'm not getting you again, so you must have dropped out for a sec. So, as ever, folks, we run this thing very tightly. So, look, what I will say, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and what I'll just say is, very interesting subjects that we went through tonight, and thanks again to Dave, as ever, for providing the platform to do it. Sorry about my internet access and my shitty microphones. It's an ongoing saga. One day, maybe, I'll be able to work it out. But, you know, if any of you have got any ideas for how I can improve my my microphone problems, get Windows 10 to actually recognise that I've plugged one in, then, please contact the show. I would love to get that situation sorted once and for all, actually, so it doesn't drive me completely around the twist. Sorry, Dave, are you back in the room?
Sorry, John.
Yeah, that's okay, mate.
Don't worry, we'll get there. Get that microphone sorted, don't worry. There'll be another update and everything will go back to normal again.
It probably will, actually. Probably mass complaints. No, I was just kind of signing off because I knew you were you were out of the room for a sec. But,
yeah.
Just quickly, I know we've got about a minute, but just the wage theft thing. I mean, this seems like pretty good. I don't know if you heard what I was saying on that one, but, you know, the kind of fines that they're putting in place for the, you know, people who have caught stealing the wages of their staff is pretty decent, pretty heavy. Coupled with the fact that Francis Leach made that how did this get to this point in the first place? It's such a common thing.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not against people doing well and being extremely wealthy. I do ask the people that work for them are treated and paid. And I just don't understand how someone who's got £1 billion want £1 billion more and then another billion and then stealing things.
Yeah, exactly.
And stealing people's pensions. How much is enough? I don't understand that. Maybe because I've got bugger all, but I'm just saying. Yeah.
But then therein is part of my point. So what we're saying, mate, that's the whole point. You know, nobody, as I said earlier, nobody becomes a billionaire in a good way. You do it by being a bastard. You do it by screwing people over. It's as simple as that. It's not something that happens with any kind of fair play. You know, it's just utterly delusional and immature, frankly, coming back to our main point of the evening. Childish to imagine that's how anything like that could ever work.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, this has been wage theft, pension theft. We had a geezer fall off a boat in the 90s, you know. Supposedly, probably living somewhere. You know, it's been going on forever and a day. And I think we're all fascinated with the fact that he fell off the boat. No one was fascinated with the fact that those poor publishing workers, printers, had lost their pension. I think Granada TV, our very own Rendell Radio, had lost his pension to Granada, or ATV being bought up by ATV, and they just nicked their pension. Rendell has to work in Asda's at 70-something, you know. But yeah. No, let's talk about the guy falling off the boat. What? Yeah, God, anyway. John? Many thanks, John. And John will be back next Wednesday from 7 p.m. Don't be sick.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you, John.
Appreciate your time. Cheers.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.